Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman, and Joseph Cooper is still recovering from his back injury, but he is doing much better, and we thank you for your warm wishes. So as I sit here in the studio every day doing this program, I have my materials, notes, computers, water, and of course, my cup of coffee. It's a must for so many of us, and yet we usually don't even think about it. Our guest today writes that a 16th of a teaspoon is a good solid dose for a habituated user. A quarter teaspoon will lead to unpleasantness, racing heart, sweating, and acute anxiety. A tablespoon will kill you. And he's talking about America's favorite drug, caffeine, in its purest form. Joining us is journalist Murray Carpenter. He's reported caffeine-related stories for the New York Times, NPR, and Wired magazine, and his work has been featured in the Boston Globe and the Christian Science Monitor, among other media outlets. His book is Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us, and he joins us via Skype. Welcome, Murray Carpenter.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being with us. So tell me, how much caffeine is in my 5-ounce cup of coffee?
Oh, 5 ounces. Not a whole heck of a lot. Maybe about 75 milligrams of caffeine. So more or less the same amount as a single Red Bull.
We usually think of Red Bull as having so much more, no?
Yeah, and that's one of the popular misconceptions about energy drinks is they're really not, you know, we often use the word sort of hyper-caffeinated or super-caffeinated for energy drinks. But relative to coffee, you know, they're really not a huge dose of caffeine. So a Red Bull would have about 80 milligrams, and the larger, you know, the double size, the Monsters or Rockstars that are 16 ounces typically, yeah, they would have about 160 milligrams, which would be, you know, less than a 12-ounce cup of Starbucks coffee.
Really? So, well, when we say, you know, 3 or 4 cups of coffee a day is okay, we don't even know what we're talking about. Are we talking about 6-ounce cups, 16-ounce cups? And, I mean, what's the average? What's okay to drink?
I'm so glad you brought this up because, really, we talk about this all the time. You know, we talk about our caffeine consumption in terms of cups of coffee, and it's really a worthless measurement. Because, of course, coffee cups can vary in size dramatically. You're drinking from a 5-ounce cup. You go into Starbucks and you get a grande, you know, that's 16 ounces. That's more than 3 times what you're drinking right there. And another really fascinating thing about this is that it's actually a Florida story. There was a researcher, Bruce Goldberger, up in Gainesville, who went into the same Starbucks 6 days in a row and ordered the same 16-ounce cup of coffee, and found that the caffeine varied, you know, it was half as strong one day as it was another day. So one day it was about 260 milligrams, a little more than 3 Red Bulls. Another day it was 560 milligrams, so as much as 7 Red Bulls in 1 cup of coffee. So the bottom line is the caffeine content in coffee can vary dramatically, and it really isn't that helpful to judge our caffeine consumption by using this term, you know, cups of coffee.
Yeah, I mean, because when you go to a doctor's office, they'll say, you know, how much coffee do you drink? And it means nothing. Because, so does it matter that the caffeine amounts vary so widely, like that Bruce Goldberger, I guess he was able to measure that.
So I think it does matter for, you know, for this reason. Most of us sort of know the optimal zone. You know, you can feel it if you're a caffeine user. You know, if you're especially tired, maybe you double up on your coffee. If you're feeling great, you might have less. But you sort of know that sweet spot. And, you know, as with any drug, if it can vary twofold from cup to cup, it's just harder to hit that perfect dose for you. So, and this is just because coffee is a natural plant, and the caffeine content naturally can vary, you know, from bean to bean. So it's just one of those interesting little quirks about caffeine.
So what is caffeine? We'll start there. What is it?
Okay, well, caffeine is a naturally occurring simple chemical compound that occurs in plants all over the world, and its primary function in plants seems to be as an insecticide. So in Mexico and Central America, South America, it's often used in the form of a cacao, you know, the plant that produces chocolate. Mm-hmm. And there's also there, but there's plants all over the world that contain caffeine. And one of the interesting things about caffeine is wherever it occurs naturally, people have figured out pretty quickly to put it to use as a stimulant. So 3,000 years ago in what's now the border of Guatemala and Mexico in that region, people were starting to use chocolate, frothy cold chocolate drinks. About 1,500 years ago, people in Eastern Africa learned that if they chewed coffee beans, they didn't then brew it as we do now, but if you chewed coffee beans, you would get this pleasant stimulating effect. And even longer ago, probably 3,000 years ago in Asia, people were learning that if you soaked tea leaves in water, you would again get this stimulating effect. And so people all over the world have learned independently to put caffeine to use.
Well, we're going to get back to some of the effects of caffeine. But just this morning, you know, I just quoted from your book about the doses of pure caffeine. And this was this online publication that I received, Take Part. It was written by Christina Brava. And it says, sometimes it only takes a... Yesterday, the Food and Drug Administration released a warning about powdered pure caffeine, usually added to drinks before workouts for an energy boost or to aid weight loss. The white substance is readily available online. And the federal advisory comes weeks after an autopsy ruled the death of a teen, Logan Steiner, in LaGrange, Ohio, a caffeine overdose. Is this becoming a new trend?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily becoming a new trend. I reported on a similar incident in the book that occurred in England, where actually the person was more looking for a recreational buzz, but similarly bought powdered caffeine online, swallowed a couple teaspoons, chased it with an energy drink, went into convulsions, heart attack, and died. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a new trend, but I do think it's something that people really need to be aware of. And FDA, in its alert, points out just how hard it can be to measure, these small quantities of caffeine. It's very powerful in its pure drug form. And as you mentioned in the intro, you know, a 16th of a teaspoon is probably all that's in our cup of coffee. And so it can be easy for someone to accidentally overdose, and I'm afraid that's what happened in Ohio. And so, you know, I guess I was saddened, but not terribly surprised to hear that news. One of the props I've carried around as I've done my talks following the publication of the book is a 100-gram bag of pure caffeine that I bought online for $10.
Oh my.
And it's, you know, it's 10 lethal doses, and you know, no questions asked. Anyone with a credit card can buy it.
That's kind of scary. So if this is a drug, which you contend that it is, why is it not regulated? And why is it so easy to obtain?
Well, it all really comes back to coffee. And the tension over caffeine regulation dates back more than 100 years. 100 years ago, in 1911, there was a very hard-charging, dynamic commissioner of the agency that would become the Food and Drug Administration. And he challenged Coca-Cola over the addition, over their use of caffeine. They were adding powdered caffeine at that time to their product, as they do today. Mm-hmm. At that time, the concentrations were higher. A Coca-Cola, an 8-ounce Coke in those days, had the same amount of caffeine as an 8-ounce Red Bull today. It was really the first energy drink. But this court challenge that the federal government challenging Coca-Cola over the use of caffeine, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And one of the real problems with regulating caffeine then as today is that even at the higher end, even Coca-Cola with its higher concentrations of caffeine that it had in those days, it's still less caffeine than most people are consuming in coffee. And so the question always becomes, you know, what would you do next? Would you regulate coffee? And so there has long been a great deal of tension over what role the government should play in regulating caffeine.
God, it's an interesting, because you wouldn't want them to, you know, all of a sudden say you can't go have a cup of coffee, or you have to show a card and you can only have a certain number of cups a day or whatever. I mean, it seems impossible.
It does. And I mean, it's automatically because it's a drug, and it's a drug that most Americans use daily, it's automatically sort of in a different category than anything else that FDA regulates. And they are now looking at this sort of new generation of energy products, trying to understand how they should regulate energy drinks, caffeinated gum, these sorts of things. And they've been looking at this for over a year, and I don't know what they're going to come up with. I suspect that they're going to try, at a minimum, to ask for better labeling, maybe some kind of advisory labels. At least, I think, what consumers need is quantified labeling. So, you know, soft drink bottlers, energy drink bottlers at this point don't even have to tell you the amount of caffeine that's in a product.
As they don't in coffee.
As they don't in coffee, right, exactly. So here's that tension, right? And it's it really is a challenge for regulators. And so while I think we're somewhat behind on regulating caffeine, I empathize with the regulators because it really is a tricky one.
So would we all be considered addicts, we caffeine users?
Well, this is a really thorny question here. And in my book, I do use the terms, addiction to describe the pattern of use and addictive to describe caffeine. One of my sources probably characterized it the best by saying it's addictive, but it's mildly addictive. And what I mean by this is that people who use caffeine tend to establish a very consistent pattern of daily use. You develop a partial tolerance, which is to say, you know, the next cup of coffee you have doesn't have the same effect on you as the first cup of coffee that you had. And one of the big things, of course, is that you feel lousy. Most of us who are habitual caffeine users feel lousy when we stop taking it, which is we experience some withdrawal symptoms. And, you know, the most common is the caffeine headache.
Right.
So it has it does have the qualities of an addictive substance.
Without the usual detriments. I mean, you can't get in a car accident, I would think, from drinking too much coffee.
Exactly. And this is where the sort of tension comes in here, is that there are people who argue that you really that addiction without sort of the accompanying psychosocial behaviors that we know from alcoholism or drug addiction. So, you know, missing work due to a hangover, crashing your car, you know, robbing a pharmacy to get your OxyContin, that without those characteristics, it's not truly an addiction. So, you know, I use the terms addictive and addiction, but I really think I'm using them in a very specific manner.
We're talking about the book Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us with journalist Murray Carpenter on today's Topical Currents. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll ask for your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
The trouble with the world today, it's plain to see, is everything as hurry up. It's rush it through, don't be slow, BLT on right to go, and coffee. I think you said coffee, and I always say coffee in a cardboard cup. The trouble with a helter-skelter life we lead is coffee in a cardboard cup. The trouble, the psychologists have all agreed, is coffee in a cardboard cup. Tell me what could possibly be drearier than having lunch in a fast food cafeteria. Seems to me a gentleman would much prefer an afternoon. How you been? Would you like the special, sir? The trouble with the world today, it's plain to see, is everything as hurry up. This ready whip, instant tea, minute rice in Miami. This coffee, I think it's a coffee. I know it's a coffee in a cardboard cup. It's all become Looney Tunes with sugar packs and plastic spoons and coffee. I think it's a coffee.
Well, there we have it. What is that, Paul?
That's a Kander and Ebb song, Sammy Goldstein performing it. It's from Girls, 70 Girls, Kander and Ebb musical.
Okay. Well, coffee in a cardboard cup. Yeah, it is. Speaking with Murray Carpenter, he's a journalist and reported caffeine-related stories for a lot of publications. And the name of his book is Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. If you want to tell us how you get your caffeine, our number, 1-800-743-9576, or any questions you have about it, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at wlrn.org. Radio@WLRN.org. So, well, let's talk about some of the positive physiological effects of caffeine. You said we develop a tolerance for it. You said the first cup is going to be more of a hit than the second cup. But do we develop a tolerance over time? Like the more we use of it, the more we need to get that feeling?
Right. Well, it's what researchers call a partial tolerance. So for most people, it's not going to go up and up and up the way some drugs do. So, but yes, you pretty quickly develop a tolerance. Your caffeine, part of the way that it functions is that it blocks neuroreceptors that for adenosine. And adenosine is basically a neurotransmitter that tells the brain that you're tired. And part of the way that we develop tolerance over time is we actually develop more of these adenosine receptors. And so, yeah, you develop a little bit of a tolerance. And one of the good sort of aspects of this is it does not take long if you quit caffeine to sort of reset your tolerance to baseline. Probably about 2 weeks for most people would be, again, to use a research term, the washout period.
But sounds like a long time to me.
What's that? Now,
that sounds like a long time to me. Excuse me for interrupting you. But 2 weeks without coffee sounds like a long time. You said it's not that long a time to get back to baseline.
Well, you're right. For most of us, that would be a very long time, and I don't know when last I went that long without caffeine.
Did you try to for writing this book?
I actually did. I quit for a very short period when I was working on the chapter on withdrawal, and I felt, you know, it couldn't possibly be quite as bad as it was, and I did what the researchers suggest, which was to sort of do a phase out. So I tapered down and got down to zero for just probably a few days, and then I sort of slowly ratcheted back up.
And did you get the withdrawal effects, the headache, and do you get a logy feeling mentally?
I would say, yeah, that would definitely describe it. Mentally logy, mentally sluggish, lethargic, and a bit of a headache. That's never been my biggest problem, but definitely a generalized headache. And something that I really hadn't anticipated, you see it in the literature that some people get muscle pains, sort of flu-like muscle pains. But that was really kind of freaky to me, was that I got muscle pains in my lower back and in my hamstrings that unlike anything that I've experienced. And so it felt sort of deep and systematic at that point. I didn't like that feeling.
No. Okay, so the positive thing. So does it actually improve our brain function and mental acuity?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, researchers and have been testing this for 100 years. And in fact, I mentioned the Coca-Cola trial, what was called the famous Coca-Cola trial of 1911. Coca-Cola at that point hired a psychologist to run some subjects through a battery of tests. They were in double blind conditions, some getting a placebo, some getting caffeine, not knowing which was which. And all the way back then, on a variety of tests, of calculations, even typing, people were responding and were able to perform more efficiently with caffeine than without. And it particularly seems to be beneficial in increasing alertness. So, I mean, we all know this, that if you're driving late at night and you're tired, a cup of coffee can help. And actually, some of the best research in this area has come out of the military.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, the military is really interested in the benefits of caffeine because the times when it can particularly help is when you're performing, you're stressed, you're excessively tired, and yet you need to be aware of what could be infrequent but potentially life-threatening stimuli. That describes a lot of military work. And so if you're on like an overnight watch, for example, it might be boring, you might be inclined to fall asleep, but caffeine could help you stay alert and engaged. So I went to a military facility in Massachusetts where they've tested caffeine on soldiers, and they've done tested a number of different products. And for military rations, they have developed applesauce called Zapplesauce. There's a caffeinated chewing gum. They have caffeinated energy bars. And this is all in addition to the instant coffee that's in so many rations. So yeah, the military is very much interested in how to use caffeine to optimize soldiers' performance.
I was wondering, what about people who do those 12 and 24 hour shifts, like doctors and nurses and bus drivers, not bus drivers, rig drivers, you know, those semi drivers? Does coffee actually help them do their jobs more efficiently, or does it ever have a reverse effect?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, you know, I should be clear that if you're in a situation where, whether you're driving or you're on call as a doctor and you're exhausted, the best thing to do is to take a short nap or to try to get some sleep. Caffeine can't improve on, you know, it can't make you better than that. But in those situations, caffeine will, you know, a good dose of caffeine can help you perform better. And again, one of the military researchers that I talked to had done some tests with subjects who stayed up for 2 and 3 days at a time. And even in those conditions, they were seeing a benefit from a small amount of caffeine.
You say that caffeine improves athletic performance. So if, in fact, it's a performance-enhancing drug, shouldn't it be banned in competitive sports like steroids, or is it just not that powerful?
Well, it is powerful. I mean, the challenge here is again, it gets back to coffee. And this really is fascinating. So I've raced bikes for years. I raced bikes in college, and I knew that a small dose of caffeine, of coffee, a strong cup of coffee, could help you race faster, or at least we all thought it could. But it turns out that really a dose of caffeine that's not much greater than you or I would have in our daily coffee will probably improve, for most people, it will improve your timed athletic performance, say over an hour foot race or an hour bike race, between 1% and 3%. And that's often going to be the winning margin in most races. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the question of whether it should be regulated, the trend has actually been towards less regulation and not more. And the reason is this, is that most Americans are consuming caffeinated coffee daily. And the amount of caffeine that it takes to optimize your physical performance is not much greater than the amount that you would be taking in coffee daily. So again, it's a regulatory challenge, I think, that's unlike any other performance-enhancing drug.
Can caffeine help with depression? Are there any studies on that?
There are certainly studies that show an association between big studies that show an association between less depression in some people and caffeine use. It's hard to say whether the caffeine use is actually improving the people's moods, or if it's the case that perhaps people who are inclined to depression may be less inclined to take caffeine.
Interesting. So we don't have a definitive answer there.
No, I mean, what we do know is, you know, the more short-term thing is that caffeine reliably improves moods in people, and this is whether you're, and again, in most people, some people are just don't like caffeine at all, and it doesn't work well with them. But for most people, whether you're a regular user or, you know, a dabbler, caffeine will improve your mood.
And, okay, so these are all the positive effects of caffeine. What are the negative effects?
Well, the negative effects, I think the two best known are quite significant. One is its effect on sleep. And sleeplessness, insomnia are huge issues in America. A lot of people are medicated for this. If you talk to, you know, a room full of people, I think maybe not the majority, but a lot of them would say, yes, I would like to sleep better. But those same people, of course, are often using caffeine, often quite heavily. Caffeine's relationship with sleep is a little tricky, because there are some people who can drink coffee, for example, right up to the moment they go to bed and sleep like babies.
Right.
But for others, the sleep disruptive effects can be significant, and it doesn't take that much caffeine. So my suggestion for people who suffer from insomnia or sleeplessness and who use caffeine is to try moderating your consumption. And, you know, seeing if it does help. It won't help everyone, but I certainly think it will help some people.
Other negative effects?
The other big one is anxiety.
Okay.
And people who suffer from anxiety caffeine can be a significant trigger, and it can either give people sort of low-grade anxiousness, the kind of thing that practically any of us might feel if we had too much caffeine, just sort of jittery and unpleasant feeling. But for people who suffer from panic disorder, people who are prone to panic attacks, caffeine can actually reliably induce a panic attack in those people, a large dose of caffeine. So it definitely has some significant health effects, and I think these are sometimes subtle enough that people don't recognize them, or at least don't attribute their problems to caffeine.
You know, you just mentioned about the person that, oh, I can sleep like a baby and has a cup of coffee right before they go to sleep. So obviously different people react differently to caffeine, which I think would be another big factor in trying to regulate it, because wouldn't it depend on your size and weight? And you say it even has a genetic component.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And yes, this is a challenge for regulators, because what would be for you or I maybe a moderate dose would for someone else just make them very jittery, and someone else might not even notice it. So yeah, some people, some families tend to be genetically predisposed either to be, sort of desensitized to caffeine. Others are genetically predisposed to being very susceptible to its effects, and the example of people who can suffer from caffeine induced panic attacks, that's definitely a familial thing. Also, of course, yeah, weight is a huge factor. So and there's some other strange things that affect how caffeine influences us. So for example, women on birth control pills, it takes them twice as long to metabolize caffeine as people who are not on birth control pills. So the same cup of coffee might have twice the effect on them. People who are smokers metabolize caffeine twice as quickly. And I'm speaking, in broad terms here.
Mm-hmm.
They need twice as much caffeine to get the same effect. So if you get a big man, 200 pounds, who's a smoker, and a small woman, say 120 pounds, who's on birth control pills, even if all else were equal, even if, genetically they were the same material, he'd need something like 5 cups of coffee to her one to get the same effect.
We have a couple of emailers, and basically what they want to ask is about decaffeinated coffee, which I was going to get to, but since I see them sitting there, how much caffeine is removed from the coffee to qualify it as decaf? And another one understands that coffee is only 6% caffeine, and when they decaffeinate it, they're only able to extract half of it, hence the marketing claim of 97% caffeine free. In other words, those who drink decaf are still getting a dose of caffeine. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it is correct that you are getting a dose of caffeine. However, it's quite small. In my reporting, I toured a decaffeinator in Texas, a very large decaffeination facility where they do millions of pounds of beans annually. And they have a lab there, and they test the batches of caffeine, and I don't remember the exact tolerance to which they have to reduce it. But typically, to bring it back to the terms we were talking in earlier, a 12-ounce cup of Starbucks coffee, for example, decaffeinated, would probably have 10 milligrams or less of caffeine. So probably, really, it would be about a tenth the amount a 20th the amount in a fully caffeinated cup that same size. And again, it's it's Bruce Goldberger up in Gainesville who's done some of this research.
So again, it really depends on who's drinking, because that sounds like such a negligible amount of caffeine.
Yeah, and again, this was one of the surprises I had in reporting this aspect of the book. I've been with people before who said, I had 2 cups of decaffeinated coffee and I'm kind of jittery. And I always sort of, I heard those stories with disbelief. But a lot of people can detect a mere 20 milligrams of caffeine. And so 2 cups of decaf, could easily be 20 milligrams of caffeine. And yeah, for some people, that would actually make them quite jittery. So again, the range is very large in how we metabolize caffeine, and there is some caffeine in decaf.
All right, let's just go to John in Delray Beach. Welcome, John.
Thank you for taking the call. Very interesting show. I wonder if your guest would talk a little bit about the difference, since we're talking mostly about cups of coffee, the difference in Robusta beans and Arabica beans, because Robusta beans, which Starbucks uses, has a lot more caffeine than Arabica beans, which, say, Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay.
All right. That is a great question. So, Robusta beans, for people who aren't aware, this is a strain of coffee that's more easily grown than Arabica. Arabica is the fussy, high mountain grown coffees that most gourmet coffees are made from. Robusta, which is often blended into the cheaper coffees, the cheaper commercial coffees, has twice as much caffeine per bean. So it's quite a bit stronger. So a cup of diner coffee might be much stronger. Now, Starbucks does use 100% Arabica beans, and as does Dunkin' Donuts and many others. So Starbucks coffee, while it's brewed strongly, the strong caffeine content is not because it's Robusta. But Vietnam, for example, has quickly become the second largest coffee growing country in the world. And that's a surprise to many people. It's behind Brazil. And much of the coffee that they're growing there is Robusta. So if you get Vietnamese coffee, which is often served with, you know, condensed milk, sweetened, that can pack a powerful caffeine kick. But yeah, the caller's point is great that there's a big variety of caffeine contents just depending on the type of bean you're using.
Okay, John.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for calling. Murray, I've heard so much about, you know, caffeine being beneficial for so many ailments. I mean, not just headaches, but haven't there been links to not developing Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and certain carcinomas?
Yes, and this is fascinating too. There, caffeine seems to have a protective effect against both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Now, this is one of the areas in which we need a lot more research, but the early research certainly hints in this direction, and the mechanism is unclear. But I mean, I think that is fascinating. And yeah, there's also an association between a decreased incidence of basal cell skin cancers, which probably in Florida is a great concern to many people.
Yes.
And caffeine consumption. So again, the mechanism is not clear, but these are two of the sort of incidental health benefits. And there's also, I mean, there's another that's significant, that's caffeinated coffee, not caffeine per se, but there seems to be a negative association with the consumption of caffeinated coffee and type 2 diabetes.
A negative association.
Which is to say, the consumption of caffeinated coffee seems to be associated with a lower incidence of type 2 diabetes.
So
it's beneficial.
So it would be a positive link.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's another one.
Yeah, and I think we have to look at all of this with a sense of hubris. You know, I mean, the there's a tendency among scientists and among journalists to sort of think, you know, our research has reached an endpoint and we sort of trumpet the next new finding. But, you know, this is a very dynamic field, and I think we're learning a lot more about caffeine every year.
Is coffee negatively linked to any diseases that you know of or that have been discovered?
Not that I'm aware of. That it will help in some way, you mean? That it's helpful in some way?
That it would hurt.
Oh, that it would hurt us.
That it would. Is it linked?
Yeah. No. Again, you know, the big ones are anxiety and
right.
Insomnia. But aside from that, no, there is, you know, a sort of secondary effect of caffeine that I think is worth discussing, which is, as soft drink consumption has increased dramatically, and over the past 70 years, soft drink consumption has increased fivefold in the country, while, and we can talk about this later, but coffee consumption has actually decreased over that same period. But all of the most popular soft drinks that we're consuming in the U.S. are caffeinated. So I think some people have a concern that the caffeine is actually perpetuating the consumption of soft drinks, which can be an unhealthful habit, in the same way that nicotine perpetuates the consumption of cigarettes. Now, that's clearly a controversial point, but if you're getting your caffeine from soft drinks and you're concerned you're either overweight or obese, I think it's worth considering changing your source of caffeine.
Is all caffeine the same? Is it the same from all sources, or is there a difference between naturally derived and synthetically produced caffeine?
That's a question I get a lot, because I'd spend a lot of time looking at the different sources of caffeine. And no, if it's pure caffeine, it doesn't matter if you're assembling it synthetically or if you're deriving it naturally. If it's pure caffeine, it's the exact same chemical. I've never seen anything to suggest that it's different. I mean, some people might have a preference that their caffeine not be made in a pharmaceutical plant, or they might prefer it to come from a natural source. But in terms of its metabolic effect, it should be the same.
Let's see. Corinne asks, she said she's heard conflicting answers on whether caffeine is harmful to children. Some say yes, others say no. My four-year-old likes to share my coffee with me once in a while. Is this okay?
Wow, that's a big issue there. One of the surprising things is that children do consume a lot of caffeine. I mean, I think among teenagers, there's an average of 75 milligrams a day. And again, because the dose is weight dependent, that can be significant. I think it all comes back to awareness. If your child seems to be healthy, sleeping well, not anxious, and is aware of, you know, how much caffeine he or she is consuming, you know, I think that's the important thing. This is one of the issues that FDA is regulating or is looking into with its regulating with this new breed of energy products, is does caffeine affect young people differently? And this is an area we need more research in this area.
We have to take a break on today's Topical Currents, and we are speaking with Murray Carpenter, a journalist who's written Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Lots more questions, and we'll get to your emails and phone calls when we return.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to sell their quota, and the way things are, I guess they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil.
And welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with journalist Murray Carpenter, and he's written Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. And we do think of so much coffee coming from South America. Where does most of our coffee come from now? You said a lot of it comes from Vietnam. Is there any place else?
Yeah, well, so a basic trend over the past, you know, 30 years or so, is African production has been down a little bit, and Vietnam has really come up. So we still, in the U.S., we still get an awful lot of coffee. There's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil, as Frank Sinatra said.
Yes.
A lot from Brazil, a lot from Colombia and Central America. And a lot of the coffee that's being grown in Vietnam, I think, is being exported to Asia and other Asian countries. So, most of our coffee is still coming from, you know, this hemisphere.
What about, you went to visit one of these big synthetic or pharmaceutical coffee production plants in China. What happened?
Well, I wasn't allowed access. It's kind of a strange story how I got there. I, as I mentioned earlier, I toured this decaffeination facility in Texas, and as a byproduct of their decaffeination, they generate about 1 million pounds of caffeine, naturally derived from coffee, that's really a byproduct, but that then is refined and sold to the soft drink industry. And the more I looked into it, I realized that, you know, that's the biggest decaf facility in the country, and they're only producing 1 million pounds, and we're using 15 million pounds of powdered caffeine annually in this country. So I started trying to figure out where the rest of it comes from. And the answer to that is it's synthesized. You can either extract caffeine from coffee or tea or some other product in which it naturally occurs, or you can synthesize it from raw materials, from petrochemical precursors. And people have known how to do this for a long time. And now most of our caffeine that we're getting for our soft drinks is coming from synthetic caffeine plants, primarily in China, but also in Germany and India. But it's a little bit of a closed industry. I tried to get a tour of each of these facilities because I had toured this decaffeination plant, and no one would allow me in.
Why is that?
Well, you know, the pharmaceutical industry in general is somewhat closed, I think, for they have a lot of regulatory concerns. And what I realized quickly is that China is a very closed industry, not just pharmaceuticals, but for a lot of other products. And so even FDA inspectors have a really hard time getting into some of these plants. And this is a trend that doesn't just affect caffeine. I mean, we are importing a lot of our pharmaceuticals now. Much of that is coming from China. The industries are very opaque, and FDA is facing a great challenge as they try to assure that the conditions in which these pharmaceutical products are being made are clean.
Right, and safe.
And safe, yeah.
And why are we importing so much from China? Why can't we produce it ourselves?
It's just so cheap. I mean, it's something like $7 a kilo coming from overseas. And again, the decaffeination facility that I saw in Texas, it's a massive plant. They use super, super critical carbon dioxide, which is carbon dioxide at high heat and high pressure. It's a very expensive process. They couldn't afford to do that if their primary product wasn't decaffeinated coffee. So it's a very expensive process, and they're just able to do it much, much more inexpensively in China.
Ray in Miami Lakes, welcome. You're on Topical Currents.
Hi, good afternoon. Okay, real quick. You've spoken several times regarding the decaffeinated aspect. You mentioned that there's petrochemicals that are used to derive the caffeine, but what chemicals are actually used to eliminate the caffeine from the bean?
Right. Okay, that's a great question. So the plant that I visited was super critical CO2. So it's carbon dioxide at high heat and high pressure, which has strange properties. It has some of the properties of a liquid and some of a gas, and it's able to flow through the beans, sort of like a ghost, and strip the caffeine out and leave the flavor. Other decaffeination facilities use methylene chloride, and there's another in Texas that does that. There was one in Montreal. And yet still others use just water. The Swiss water process is probably the best known of these. And I think the closest large plant doing that is in Vancouver. And so there are a number of different processes and different chemicals used for each of the processes, and in some cases just water. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And what are the, for example, they use you mentioned meth chloride? Is that
yeah.
Correct? So what residuals or what impurities are left over from this decaf process, and you actually consume it, and what side effects are there, if any?
Right. Well, I'm actually out of my level of expertise, but my understanding is that it's fairly clean, but I can't, this is not something that I really got into in my book, and I could understand that some people would have concerns about it.
Right. Okay, Ray, thanks so much. Okay, Janet wants to know about Cuban coffee. Hi, Janet.
Hi, thank you for the speaker. Being in South Florida and having our Cuban coffee fix, what would be the difference in the caffeine in a regular Cuban coffee than, I guess, a regular espresso from Starbucks?
Yeah, now Cuban coffee, let's see, I associate with it comes in a small cup and it's often sweetened, correct?
Right.
Okay, and is it typically pulled as an espresso, right? It's not brewed.
Exactly. Well, it's brewed as an espresso.
As an espresso, espresso. Right, but not drip filtered, rather.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, this will be a generalization because I haven't seen comparisons on Cuban coffee itself. But generally, of course, an espresso will have per ounce more caffeine. The extraction is greater. It's a stronger dose of caffeine per ounce. But beyond that, I really couldn't say. I will say, you know, some of the research I cite in the book about espressos, particularly in Scotland, researchers found, again, very dramatic differences in caffeine contents, even in espressos. So I don't know if that, does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, I was kind of curious just because that is the local cuisine down here, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, and I love Cuban coffee. When I've visited Florida, and I think it's delicious.
We get two drugs at once in the Cuban coffee.
There you go.
Sugar, caffeine.
Yes.
Okay, Janet, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Eric wants you to talk about, if you know, caffeine's interactions with other drugs. I was going to ask you about its interaction with alcohol. Are there other, tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, now I'm not sure about interactions with other drugs. I would say for sure if you're on any prescription medications and you're a caffeine user, I would suggest discussing it with your physician. The interactions with alcohol again are pretty significant. And Bruce Goldberger in Gainesville did some of the research on this. Do you remember about 4 years ago there was concern about the alcohol caffeine blend called Four Loko?
Yes.
Right. Well, it's caffeine, not just pre-blended as Four Loko was, but is often used. Red Bull and vodka, for example,
mm-hmm.
is a very popular product. And for years, of course, just rum and coke has been popular, which has much lower caffeine contents. But there seems to be an association between increased risky behavior and the consumption of caffeine with alcohol. It's not clear that that you can blame the increase in risky behavior, which is to say, more people who plan to drive while impaired after they've had caffeine and alcohol than those who have just had alcohol, or even risky sexual behaviors. But there is an association, and it may be that some people are sort of risk takers and they're more inclined to consume caffeine and alcohol. But it can definitely be a dangerous mix. And I think one researcher more or less suggested to me that it's going to give you the energy to do things when you're inebriated that you wouldn't otherwise do. So if you're drinking to excess and consuming caffeine, I think it's a bad idea. And it's also worth noting that this idea that caffeine is going to sober you up when you're drunk is sort of a misperception.
Yeah, a lot of people, I guess, think that maybe it gives them the courage to get behind the wheel that they otherwise wouldn't have, or the energy to get behind the wheel.
But you're still going to be impaired, and right. I think this is one of those sort of myths that's been perpetuated for years. The sort of classic drunk guy in the bar in the movie, and the bartender gives him a cup of coffee and sends him on his way. It's if you're impaired, you're impaired, and caffeine is not going to really help.
I guess we have very little time left. I just was wondering how climate change might be affecting growing conditions for coffee. How is that changing it?
It's making it. That's a really great question. It's making it more and more difficult to grow coffee. When we were talking earlier about the sort of premium coffees, the Arabicas that we like, that are often grown at high elevation in Africa, Central America, and South America, they require a very specific blend of precipitation and sunshine. And it's getting harder and harder to find that. I think there have been more unpredictable storms and more forecast for some of these areas. And so growers are very much concerned about the challenges that climate change will pose.
So it might become scarce? What a thought.
I hesitate to say that because we're always there's always a new story about
right.
how scarce coffee is going to become, but we tend to have circles of dearth and abundance. But I do think for people who grow the finest coffees, the finest Arabicas, they are facing increasing challenges due to climate change.
Well, Murray Carpenter, he's a journalist. He's reported on caffeine-related stories for the New York Times, NPR, Wired. And his book is Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Thank you so much, Murray Carpenter, for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Bonnie, for having me on.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer's Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. And free audio archives and downloads and links to today's book at WLRN.org and on our Facebook page. Bonnie Berman, thanking you for joining us.